I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Legislation Committee for Monday, May 17th. It's 12:15, and we are joined by members of the committee, Legislator Rogowski, who's also here in his capacity as Chair of the Public Safety Committee, Legislator Burton, Legislator Harcum, Legislator Williams, Alfreda, Legislator Myers, and Legislator Abinanti will be flitting back in here momentarily, I hope.
Is flitting a legal term?
He flits around, you know, he flits around like a butterfly.
Like butterflies.
Mr. Chairman, let me take this opportunity to call the meeting committee on public safety and security to order. We have a quorum.
Okay.
And
we're here today as part of our ongoing review of county laws. And we're by our PACE law school interns. Actually, we're joined by Kristen Barino today. She's no longer a law student. She's now a law school graduate.
Wow. Congratulations.
Have you taken the bar yet?
No.
And her particular area of research was to look at some of our public safety laws. And so we're going to discuss three of them today that she looked at that are relevant to public safety. That's why it was we're having a joint meeting. And one is the law regulating toy or imitation firearms, which is Chapter 530 of Westchester County Code. This is the order we're going to take them in. Then 527, gun safety, and then 698, driving while intoxicated or ability impaired vehicle impoundment law, which doesn't deal with forfeiture but impoundment. So let's start with the toy or imitation firearm.
John, I just wanted to mention that you were so fortunate that Kristen has done internships with the DA's office. So when she was assigned the criminal area, she's brought a lot of background.
That's why Kristen actually took these particular laws, because she has been working with the DA's office. And with Kristen is Betsy DeSoy, who supervises the interns. And we're also joined by Marty Gleason from the from County Attorney's Office and Roger McKinkey.
Rokinkey
from the Public Safety Commissioner's Office.
Chief Rokinkey.
Yes. Kristen, why don't you go through the toy or imitation firearm law?
So our county toy or imitation firearm law right now makes it illegal to sell, distribute, or manufacture imitation firearms. And our law specifically references Penal Law 265 with respect to what a firearm is. And it also makes it illegal for a person to possess a toy or imitation firearm with the intent to use it to commit a crime. After looking at the federal law and the state laws, it looks like our law doesn't really sync up that well with the state law. We have some things that the state law is much more strict on. For most of the factors, it's more strict on. The only thing that our law is a little bit more strict on is the colors of the firearm. So the general business law section 870 makes it illegal for, it only talks about sale, distribution, and manufacture. It doesn't talk about possession at all. But it makes it illegal to obviously sell, distribute, or manufacture. And it the firearms that it talks about has much more distinct markings on it. Our law doesn't talk about, the state law talks about an orange stripe on the side of the gun to make it very obviously a toy. Our law doesn't talk anything about that. The federal law actually talks about an orange plug in the nozzle of the toy gun, and our law doesn't talk about that at all. The state law only uses the colors, I think it's blue, black, brown, or silver. Our law expands that a tiny bit, but to include aluminum or green. But that's the only way, with respect to how the gun looks, that our law is stricter.
When you're talking about the state law here, are you talking about the general business
general
law
business
or
law.
The penal law?
The general business law. Our law is bifurcated and includes a criminal and civil aspect.
Right.
And it goes with the general business law, and then there's a portion that I'm going to talk about the criminal law.
Mr. Chairman,
more.
Can I
Can I ask?
No.
Can she explain to us what the state law does and what our law does?
Yeah. I think she started doing that.
Right. So just to clarify, our county law addresses both the civil penalty and the criminal penalty. And in the state law, it comes under the general business law in terms of the civil side. And the criminal law is penal law section 265.
Okay. Kristen, tell us what the general business law, that prohibits the sale, manufacture,
distribution
of anything that looks like a toy weapon as that's defined in the law.
Right.
So anything else on 870 or the general business law provisions that we should know about?
Betsy actually gave me an article in Cranes about how this New York state law is being actively enforced. It's being taken very seriously. And the Attorney General's office is, going around to all different areas and making sure that toy guns aren't being taken off the shelves. And a lot of stores still have these kinds of things on the shelves and aren't aware of the law, so they're actively taking part to make sure that the law is being enforced. Conversely...
So on the general business law section, that prohibit sale, manufacture, distribution. That law is enforced by the Attorney General.
Yes.
Okay. So now let's move to the other side, the criminal law side, as opposed to the civil law side.
While the civil law side, the state law is a little bit stricter than our county law, it's the opposite with the criminal side. The criminal law in 265.01...
Which you should all have, by the way.
Subsection 2 says that criminal possession of a weapon in the fourth degree includes possession with the intent to commit a crime of an imitation pistol. It doesn't use the word firearm, whereas the county law uses the word firearm. So the criminal law is a little less strict. The general business law is a little bit more strict. Also, for penalties, I forgot to mention this when I was talking about the general business law. Our county law says that the penalty is a fine not more than $1,000 or imprisonment up to 1 year. The general business law says that the penalty is $1,000 per violation, meaning per gun that's in the store. So that's much more strict.
And how about the
fine?
How about the criminal? I mean, our law... If you look at our law, which is Chapter 530, it combines manufacture, sale, use, or possession. So just so everybody's clear, the state law takes manufacture and distribution and sale and puts it in a civil side, enforced by the Attorney General, and the criminal side is in the penal law, and that's enforced by the district attorney. But our law puts them all in one, in one provision, 530.03, which makes it unlawful to sell, offer for sale, distribute, manufacture, use, or possess any toy imitation firearm, and has that same penalty for both civil or criminal. Well, actually makes it all criminal, sale, use, manufacture, which is different than the state law, right?
Right.
What's the criminal penalties under the state law?
It's a Class A misdemeanor, so it's the same imprisonment, not exceeding 1 year.
So, and a fine if not more than, what about the fine?
I'm actually not sure if the criminal law has a fine on it.
Well, it's probably not right in that section. It's probably in the section that where they deal with the levels of crime and they specify the penalties.
Section 7.0, the fines. It's 7.00. I don't forget.
More to
We don't have a chart, do we, showing the three?
We don't have it.
Okay. No. So the question then comes to, with respect to our law, who is enforcing it? And that's why we asked Chief Rokicki to come. And I guess the, our Department of Public Safety doesn't enforce this law.
I seem to recall when this legislation was introduced, the Department of Consumer Affairs was going to get involved with this through their inspectors. And the, you know, we only patrol municipalities such as Cortland and right. some of our park businesses like Playland, where they might even have shops that sell these types of toys. So we really never got into the inspection business, and we researched our records, and we can't find of any case where we've arrested anyone for using a non-clearly marked toy gun during the commission of a crime. So we have no enforcement history of either selling or possessing with intent to use it during the course of a crime.
Thank you. To the point about consumer protection, I know they were at least warning people about this because two merchants in my district complained to me. You know, I'm not weighing either side of the law, just point of fact that at some point Consumer Affairs was at least warning merchants about the law and the possible consequences of selling toy guns. I don't know if they still are. Were you able to take that up with them?
No, we weren't able.
Okay, I think that input would be helpful.
We'll have to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And maybe get a better idea what the Attorney General is doing also.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, I've had a long history dealing with gun control in Westchester County. So long, in fact, that if you look at 265 Subdivision 1, just an anecdote, the word cane sword appears, and if you look, you'll see there was an amendment in 1969, Chapter 123 of the laws of the state of New York. I wrote that section that added that when I was working for the state legislature.
We have a round of applause.
Thank you.
Here, here.
But I was also here when
and
Lou Marciello...
Only, you were only five at
and
the time.
And I was only five at the time. But
and you owned a toy gun.
And I owned a toy gun. Well, that was a cane sword. These are amazing devices. I mean, you know, a guy's got a cane, he goes like this, and he's got a sword that's this long in his hand. At any rate, I was also here when Lou Marciello proposed, and we probably unanimously passed this amendment. And what we did was we analyzed at that time the different laws and found the holes. And this law was intended to plug in all the holes. It was modeled, I happen to have the original legislation here from 2000. It was modeled on New York City's ordinance. And the attempt was to ban the possession, which I think you said right. is not banned by state law. And this was not a consumer affair.
It is banned by state law.
Only in certain circumstances, not other types.
Sure, the state criminal law bans imitation pistols, whereas our law bans imitation firearms. So our law is a little bit broader.
It would include imitation rifles, shotguns, machine guns, and things like that, which the state law apparently does not prohibit. It also, from what I'm just reading the sponsors, the committee report way back then, it adds brown and green to the list. I think you
yeah,
said that.
Right.
It adds different colors and criminalizes the possession of only those toy or imitation guns used to facilitate the commission of a crime. So it was a law enforcement effort as well as, it wasn't really a consumer affairs issue, it was a law enforcement issue. And if you remember back in 2000, if I remember correctly, I don't have all the information in the file, but I remember it, there was a rash of situations where people were holdups or whatever using toy guns. And that's what this was intended to do. The state never changed the state law. So it might be helpful if we had a chart comparing what each one of the laws did so we can see whether the stuff that we passed, that we banned, has since been picked up by the state and whether it's necessary to continue doing it. But I think it was a law enforcement effort so that you know, somebody brandishing something that looks like an actual firearm and uses it to go in and rob a bank would be able to be charged with using a weapon as opposed to just, I don't know, what you charge them with.
Well, but again, that would have been after the fact. We weren't assigned to go inspect toy stores or...
Correct. No. This was not designed, I don't think, as a consumer affairs issue. This was designed as a law enforcement measure.
But it does make it unlawful to sell, distribute, or manufacture.
Right, but it also makes it unlawful on the street.
I know, but...
So somebody's selling a gun that looks like a real gun. We also had another measure, I don't know if
Wait. Before
which talks about painting guns to look like artificial guns.
Take it one step at a time.
Right.
All right. Where is the provision in 26501 that deals with the toys?
It's subsection 2. It says a person is guilty of criminal.
And it just says imitation pistol. So that's the difference. That's the difference between the state law and our law, which is broader than imitation pistol.
Right.
It talks about a toy firearm.
Exactly.
Which could be a toy rifle or something
right.
like that. Okay. So that turning to this, the manufacture, sale, or distribution, we don't know who in Westchester County enforces that, if anybody. That's so. Let's focus on that. I mean, what when you
state commerce problem?
What when you? Well, if it's in a store in Westchester,
manufacturer
is the problem. What was the idea when you enacted this as to who was going to go around and check stores to see whether?
I think this was the same concept of you ban the illegal sale of guns. You know, nobody goes around checking stores to see. You know, I mean, I guess there's somebody checks the gun dealers. But if somebody's selling on the street a toy gun that looks realistic, you can and is selling several of them and handing them out to gangs on the street or whatever, then you can trace it back and you stop the source. I mean, this was a law enforcement thing. This was not people raiding toy stores.
My vague memory of this thing was that it was supposed to be used in prosecution. Once
right.
you had arrested somebody, then you had an additional violation.
Exactly.
That you could nail them with, either add time to them or at least use as a bargaining chip.
Right.
The idea wasn't to go scouring the streets for these things because that's utterly impractical.
Exactly.
But if they show up in the five and dime, that means you want them.
So you're saying that if you were to arrest somebody for using a toy weapon in a crime, you would trace back where that person
If you hold
went.
Up the liquor store with it, and then that's one thing. If you have a plastic gun with you, that's a second violation.
Right, but
so there,
then track as to where that person got the gun.
Well, then you could.
And if they got it in a store,
you could conceivably take it back that way, too.
Or you could go back to somebody on the street who may have sold a dozen of them, and these look really realistic.
Well, you got to find the person on the street.
What?
Yeah.
You have that problem.
I'd like to know if that's ever been done.
Probably not.
That's why the chief's here.
Well, the chief would know what our department does, but he
Absolutely.
Would not necessarily know what the 43 police departments in Westchester County do. And the DA could tell us whether... So I really think we need some data from the district attorney's office.
Mr. Chairman, also the actual prevalence of the problem. I mean, one can assume there are 1,000 toy guns out there, or there might be no toy guns out there. You know, so there's an assumption of just because there haven't been any arrests or something, and in theory, no one's using a toy gun. They're using real guns, or they're not using anything.
And then what about the federal law? Can we go through that? There's also a federal statute.
The federal law, I actually thought it was a little bit surprising that it doesn't, the state law doesn't match up with the federal law either. The federal law, again, bans imitation firearms. It uses the same colors as the state law. It doesn't include the brown, green, or aluminum. But the thing that's distinguishing about the federal law is that instead of saying, as in the state general business law, that it needs an orange stripe on the side, it just says it needs an orange plug in the barrel.
And we don't have those.
We don't have that either. We just our law just says that the barrel has to be plugged. It doesn't say by a certain color or anything like that. It just says it has to be plugged by the same material that it's made out of. Right. And the federal law does mention, I'll just read it, the provisions of this section shall supersede any provision of state or local laws or ordinances which provide for markings or identification inconsistent with provisions of this section. So the federal law does say that it needs those certain things for the law to stand.
So
technically the state law is not following the federal law.
Right. The state law doesn't have the orange plug either, but...
So the federal law, read that again.
Sure. We don't have a copy of that.
We don't have the federal
law. Yes,
you
do. It's on the reverse side of the general business law, the long sheet. It should be one long sheet. Yes.
It's subsection G at the bottom. Provisions of this section shall supersede any provision of state or local laws or ordinances which provide for markings or identification inconsistent with provisions of this section.
So this would preempt our law, which has all these different colors.
No, they're not inconsistent.
Mr. Chairman?
They're not inconsistent.
Yes.
If I may, I think there's some case law that says that the federal preemption is limited to the, I read a Court of Appeals case that said it's limited to those on the very bottom of that section, if you look, there's a listing of types of laws that would be preempted under this law. One of them, I think, has to do with BB gun. I don't have it in front of me, excuse me.
BB, paintball, pellet firing, air guns.
The Court of Appeals ruled that, it's limited to those specific designations and not to...
Which is the antique firearm or the traditional BB, paintball, or pellet firing, air guns, that one?
It's air guns. It has an air gun exemption. Mm-hmm.
And the Court of Appeals said that with regard to New York City statute, which was very broad and even prescribes just mere possession of it, you know, toward pistol, without any intent whatsoever to commit a crime, said that it could live along with this federal law, that it wasn't preempted, and that the express provisions of the federal law limited the preemption to these areas.
I believe you can read all three consistently. They're not inconsistent. They are different, but not inconsistent. And I think each one is designed to plug the hole that the other one leaves.
Yeah, I guess the answer is, the question I have is, yeah, that's the case, but who's doing anything to enforce our law? Who's doing anything to enforce it? And has there been any enforcement of it? Has there been any prosecutions of it?
Well, Jim, I think it might be a point that Legislator Burt made. It's the enforcement would come if and when there's an arrest on some other action in which a toy pistol was used, and you know, so it's not just because no one is going out to the stores.
Just shows that it's effective.
That may not have been. No.
Well, wait, Marty. To that point, though, people have gone out to the stores.
Okay.
So there could be a preventative aspect of this. We know Consumer Affairs, at least in my district, in two very specific cases, because I got complaints about it, went to stores and said, "You see these guns on your shelf here? These toy guns." Under county law, these are illegal. You're not allowed to sell them. They look too much like real guns. If I come back and they're still here, you're going to be
so
in trouble.
So that actually happened.
Yeah, two cases.
So what's wrong with that?
Oh, nothing. I'm just saying it for the record because people have been saying there hasn't been enforcement, but there should be more prevention, and it was handled by Consumer Affairs.
Well, maybe we should clarify the reason for this meeting. Where I think the legislation committee, right, John, is looking at laws that if they're not being implemented or sort of passe, maybe take them off the books.
Or if they should be.
So it sounds like this.
So maybe we should have Consumer Affairs come in and tell us what they've done. But also, on the other issue that Legislator Burton raised, I'd still like to know from the DA what prosecutions they've had under 265.014 on the toy, and have they been able to trace back?
It seems to me that's really important because if the premise of what we're doing is reviewing laws to see whether or not they are obsolete, either because informationally they're obsolete or by some sort of preemption, or they've simply never had anything going on, and we could. There are enough examples of this thing in federal legislation, I'm sure there are around here. What we found is that so far, we have no indication this law has ever had an impact. So let's find out.
Or there's a fourth thing I would mention, and that is if we have a law on the books that we think should be on the books, but it's not being effectively enforced, to get it effectively enforced.
Right. So. Well, Pete and I were just discussing on the side the question of how it was that the Consumer Affairs was in a store and picked up on this matter. One could presume that they were there for, let's say, an item pricing check.
Or a
tobacco matter. And they just happened upon this. Somehow the inspector was sensitive to this matter and saw it. But that doesn't imply a regular process of enforcement, or maybe it does. Maybe, I mean, who's not? I would think that we'd also want to bring in Consumer Affairs to ask this question.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's two follow-ups. One is Consumer Affairs, and the other, I guess, would be in the district attorney's office, what record they have of enforcing 265.014 and our local law, whether they've brought any prosecutions under our local law. I don't know if you expected the DA to do that, or?
No, I mean, it's there in case it happens.
But who would you expect to make the to bring the charge, prosecute the charges under our county law? Would you expect
the
a local prosecutor or the DA?
It would be the DA.
Yeah,
but I think, as Mr. Burton said, as Legislator Burton said, that's this is for that odd circumstance where somebody goes in and robs a bank with a toy gun, and for whatever reason it's brown, and it's a rifle, and it just doesn't fit the state law. And so we would look pretty terrible if somewhere along the way somebody does this and we have a repeal of the law.
No law against it.
Right. And that's why I think it would be helpful to have a chart to see what we duplicate and what we do differently.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful to put that in a chart form.
Because it was intended to plug the holes.
You know, the definition of a firearm, federal law, state law, our law. And the penalties, federal law, state law, our law.
And also what's prohibited under each and try to match them up.
Manufacture, sales, distribution.
What about the colors and the markings?
Yeah, well, that would be the definition of a firearm, right? Because that's how they define a toy firearm.
Well, the state law does have that orange stripe on the side that we don't have, and the federal law doesn't have either.
But we say we ban more colors, so to speak.
Right.
Then the state only bans what color?
It bans blue, black, silver, I think.
Blue, black, silver, but we ban brown, green, or aluminum.
Right. So.
Tom had a rough day that day when he passed the. All those colors.
Yes.
If I may, if history serves me, I was not here for the county law, but I remember clearly when the city law was passed, it was also after a child, I believe, had been shot by a police officer.
I think you're right.
Because
they had a toy gun.
Because
yes.
They had a toy gun,
yes.
That looked very
I think
real.
You're right.
And I think that was part of the impetus of the New York City law. You know, God forbid a law enforcement official comes across a child with something that looks like a real gun.
I think you're correct.
And I think that's where the consumer protection side got in, was that they didn't want people selling these things, you know, unless they were like bright orange so everyone from a mile away could tell it was a toy.
I think you're correct. This has always been the problem in the city of New York. I remember when I was back in law school and we were prosecuting JD cases, and the kids were standing at, you know, in down the subways with guns, the toy guns. And this was the beginning of the youth crime wave that has since now they're using real guns, unfortunately. But way back then, they were, and as it moved up, people were afraid it was going to move into the suburbs.
Any other questions? We have our follow-ups. We'll get
the youth
consumer affairs and the DA data.
Exactly. Those
youths
are now 40, right?
Do you want to add anything on
this? The youths.
I'll just repeat. We researched our records. We haven't made any proactive arrests. We haven't made a lot of shopkeepers, salespeople, anything like that. And so, I've been here a long time. I can't recall ever having arrested anyone with one of these outlaw
immigration
systems.
Yeah.
Marty, you
want to
add anything?
No.
Okay. Can we know if the district attorney has a cross-referencing system that would tell us under what acts or what laws are broken? Well, let's say they bring an arrest for burglary. Well, they may list four causes of action. Is there a cross-reference of all of that similarly in this way?
It's a good question to
ask. Do we know whether their data processing system includes that?
It's a good question to ask them. Yeah.
A little bit off topic, but it does seem to be
the
sort
question.
Of thing that... because if they have arrested somebody for a hold-up of a 7-Eleven, and it turns out that they could have gotten them under for the weapon, the toy weapon, but either they did or they didn't.
Right.
The sort of thing we should know.
Okay, the next one we'll go to is the gun safety law, which is section... which has no state or federal counterpart, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. The question... we have some questions about this law. It's chapter 527. And it's got several different provisions. One deals with storage of weapons, one deals with transfer of weapons, and one deals with notices that have to be placed in retail businesses selling weapons. Did you want to give a quick report about this?
I think that the major thing that we wanted to know with regard to this law was, again, how it's being enforced. If there's been any you know, if there's been any enforcement at all, what anybody's doing to enforce it. So
let's start. The first part of it is the requirement that there be certain, that guns be stored in a certain way in people's homes. And the question I had is, you know, how does this law enforce in a person's home? You know, what's the basis for going into someone's home and inspecting how they store guns? And so that's why, Chief, hopefully you could cast some light on that.
Yeah, one of the things, I oversee the pistol permit unit, and probably 15 years ago, judges who were the issuing officer, you know, we're just investigating on the process. I forget who it was. The judge said, this guy's starting to accumulate quite a few firearms. Are you sure they're safeguarded? So I says, take a ride up there, take a look. And we did. And it started, and it became, now it's done by written order from an issuing officer. I can supply you with copies of those orders. And in 2008, we revised our applicant's manual for applicants for pistol permits. And in cooperation with the then administrative judge, Frank Nicolai, we collaborated on this thing. And we also have instructions in our manual here. And pretty much stated to the applicant, you may be subject to a home visit to make sure your guns, once you reach five or more firearms, your guns are properly safeguarded. So
it's only applied if there's five or more guns, even though the law doesn't restrict the number?
You know, you could have 100 guns on a pistol permit, but I guess if the judges made this arbitrary decision, five guns would be a suitable number to start asking and inspecting the whereabouts. They have gun locks, and if not, they're in a safe or a file cabinet or something like that.
Okay, so, well, we have some questions. So let's start with the questions. Ask some questions too, but we'll start with Legislator Harkin and then Legislator Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The five gun, you said a judge kind of arbitrarily decided that. Has that ever been challenged in court, do we know?
Well, you know, I take it when a judge sends you a letter saying to do something, I take it as a court order, and I don't know. I just don't know.
I got to interrupt you for a second. Is it a court order or is it a letter?
It's a letter.
It's a letter. So the judge sends a letter saying go to this person's house and inspect their way of storing guns if it's over five guns.
Yes. Or, actually, and I can tell you also there's been some long-term renewals where someone renews a permit after 10 or 15 years, and the judge may also say, go back and see what's going on there. The guns are still there, and, you know, there's no changes to the permit, the number of guns. The judge may also ask to go back, us to go back there and take a look, make sure the guns are still being safeguarded.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I first became a legislator in 2006, I was chair of the Public Safety and Security Committee. And one of the first issues that came up was because then Deputy County Executive Larry Schwartz was pushing, as part of the legislative package, a revision, wholesale revision on the matter of how licensing was done. It created a firestorm, as the chairman has said. One of the pieces of education that I got from the gun owners and shooters in this county was the degree to which the regulation already existed. And I do recall very clearly this five-gun rule. It was explained to me that the shooting community, while it had some division in this, generally supported this because of the concern that people either, because of the process of renewal being as loose as it was, the accumulation factor and the aging factor of the individuals who held the weaponry was somewhat a concern, and the judges had in effect taken this on as their own personal cause, and that it was not a part of legislation. It didn't seem to bother the shooting and gun owning community, but it was extra legal, and I think this is a something that, because it's both a law enforcement and a gun ownership issue, is sensitive. But it seems to me that there was a coming together on this as being a good idea, and whether we should consider putting this into law strikes me as something worthy of discussion with all stakeholders concerned. I don't know, Chief, is that your, is that, did I accurately describe that, or do you, you think
much,
that's the consensus?
Yes, and as far as it becomes part of our local permitting process, which is also outlined in state law, I don't think the county police have a problem with it. We're enforcing the judge's concerns now. I mean, if we codify it, so much the better.
Mr. Chair, do we have a bespoke unit that does this, or are there just officers one at a time available basis?
Full-time assignment.
Full-time assignment to doing the checking, or to overall the whole permit process?
Well, there's five detectives assigned to the licensing unit, so any one of them can go out and do a house inspection.
I see. So how many, it's a pretty large unit.
Rough estimate as to how many of these you do a year? House inspection.
I would think we do probably 100 a year.
100. And that's only where there's more than five guns,
yes.
Or?
Or for any special occasion that the judge may direct.
Now, is there anything in the license application that where the applicant consents to a search in their house? Is there anything they sign that says I consent to a search in my house?
They don't consent, or they're made aware that they may be subject to this inspection.
Okay, can I see that?
On administrative basis, they
don't consent, they don't get the license.
Well, as a lawyer, and I don't know if it bothers, I just get a little concerned when you have a law that's kind of simple like this, but then there's a whole practice that builds up around it through letters from judges, that the law ought to either be very clear on what it allows the government to do, rather than have it, you know, developed as a tradition, which could be subject, in my mind, to challenge.
Well, that was why I brought this up, is that the codification of this five-gun for a 15-year renewal, because there is the process of renewal, as I recall, is not especially onerous.
No.
So
and actually, there's no sanction if you don't renew.
Right. So
you're not revoked.
So it I think it occurs to me. You just look at the age of the permit holder and say, gee, maybe we want to go take a look. He's 79 and whatever.
You're not revoked.
So I think this is interesting, but it certainly does have a real civil rights violation aspect to it.
There are questions, and it may be clarified because the Supreme Court is supposed to decide a case by the end of June, I say, dealing with the applicability of the Second Amendment to the states. The case, District of Columbia v. Heller, which was decided a few years ago, which did restrict the ability of the municipal government to regulate certain aspects, not licensing, but certain aspects of firearm ownership and protection, was only applicable to the District of Columbia and in the federal system. But there's a pending Supreme Court case that should address the issue of whether the Second Amendment is applicable to the states. And Marty, are you familiar with that
the
case?
The Heller case, yes.
It should be.
Well, a follow-on case that the chairman is referencing.
Right. It's gone to the Chicago case. Right. It came out of Chicago. I think it's still pending before the court.
Yeah, and I think they're probably, you know, their term ends in June.
They're running out of time.
And they usually issue their their rulings for this soon. By the end of June. Tom, I wanted to give you a chance to comment since you are the historian, the legal historian.
Yeah, I've been involved in this since 1991. And every one of these things that we're talking about was carefully negotiated out between the gun control advocates and the...
The fact that the judges would order inspections by letter was negotiated?
No, the reason that's accepted, I believe, is because it's a condition of issuing the license.
I just asked that.
There's a
if
whole...
If the inspection was a condition of issuing a license, that is apparently not.
Well, there's some question under state law whether the judge has the right to restrict the license. And the gun groups have always said that they don't. And so we stayed away from that when we drafted this legislation. But they've kind of looked, the gun owner groups have kind of looked the other way, recognizing that there's a safety issue here. And the law you're talking about right now, this Safe Storage Act,
right,
came about after negotiations the NRA guy still opposed it, but Scott's group, what was that called?
Westchester Gun Owners.
Yeah, Westchester Gun Owners supported it. What happened was there was legislation, frankly, that I proposed, and then Andy Spano picked it up. He brought down Elliot Spitzer. There was a whole big, we had hundreds of people at the county center, but that was just on gun locks. And then Jimmy Mezzano and I met with the gun owners, and we negotiated out what eventually
became. It's all very nice, but it's not in any written document, and the Gun Owners Association, I think, have a problem with the way the inspections are being done.
Well, the law does not call for inspections, but what the administration wanted was to take the licensing away from the judges and put it in the police department or a separate agency. And that never happened because part of the agreement with the gun owners was we would leave it with the judges. So while the gun owners are not happy with the fact that some judges sometimes order inspections, I think they're willing to leave the system alone.
It was a trade-off.
Yes, exactly. And they're willing to...
If the judges in charge, if the judges want to do this, that would be okay.
Exactly. But it was all tacit.
But I think John's point is still applicable.
Yeah. I mean, there was never a specific quid pro quo, but it was kind of like, leave this part of the system alone and we'll negotiate with you on this other part of the system. Just like, for example, the renewal of handgun licenses is not us, it's the state. If you read the state penal law, there's an exemption, there are two exemptions, one for New York City, actually it's three, one for New York City, one for Nassau, Suffolk, and there's one for us. And the three provisions are different. And so it's under the state law. And you're correct, it's called a recertification. That was the language that we negotiated out to get the cops to be able to go back and look again and pick up a gun if it's not recertified. I mean, that's the whole concept. You're right. It is an interesting question. I mean, technically, you're in violation of the penal law if you don't recertify.
Right.
But technically, you're also, your license still isn't, the gun is not,
right.
I'm not sure if the gun's illegal or not at this point.
No, it's not. Your permit is still in effect. It's not revoked. Only the judge can revoke your license.
Right. But you could go back to the judge and say, hey, these guys didn't renew. And so if the county clerk's office wanted to send the list, then the judge could, then the judge could revoke. So there's a due process part to this whole thing. Yeah.
The guy could be dead for 10 years and not having
renewed. Yeah, that's a different issue.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's the reason why we did that. Right. I mean, there was a gun in Tarrytown not long ago that they found was connected with a homicide, and the guy had moved to Florida and left the gun with his son-in-law or something. And for whatever reason, they just never followed up. But that was, it was intended to prevent that kind of circumstance. Yeah. So this whole thing has been very... Yeah, it's been negotiated out.
Well,
you were here, right? You remember that whole thing.
Something's been negotiated, but I'm not sure the way the practice is developed has been fully negotiated.
Well, you got the same problem with guns giving judges giving carry full carry licenses in some cases, and others. It's another issue, but it's akin. It's akin to this whole issue.
There's another provision of this law that requires retail businesses that sell weapons to post this notice. Do you know how that's enforced? Does anybody go out and check the?
Well, we'll visit gun shops when someone's applying for the gun the dealer license.
Right.
But after that, we have no reason to go there unless we find something really wrong on an application. We right. run the weapons that are being registered to make sure they're not stolen.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, basically good police work.
And again, we don't know if Consumer Affairs does anything, but we can check.
Do you guys check? Can I? Do you guys check gun shows?
Well, we don't have any more in Westchester.
Yeah,
none at all.
That's like the county center and the track of the last two we've had.
Right, that was closed down.
That was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. So, can I keep this, by the way?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Oh, could you send me a copy?
No,
I bought this at the last gun show that Westchester County had.
To reference myself.
You want it back? And
oh, God.
Okay.
That's
right.
What's it
say? Improvised explosives.
And then,
well,
that's
this is one of the reasons we got the county executive to close
some of the letters that the judge is sending, so we can see, you know, what the form of that is. But I'd like to look into this a little further on, you know, on whether we need to stay more on our law and you know, expand it or clarify it, because I think it poses some issues. Not the law itself, but basically how it's enforced and how it's implemented, it raises, in my mind, some issues.
There are questions here of preemption also, of how far we can go, because we were able to go for gun safety, but anything that imposes any conditions on the permit itself...
that's state law.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's why the judges here, as the licensing officers, are kind of like treading right down that line of how far they can... Over a certain number, it goes into somebody else's jurisdiction, doesn't it?
Well, a type of weapon goes into the type of firearms license for automatic weapon, explosives.
Well, who licenses the dealers?
Both federal government and state of New York.
Does anybody inspect on their behalf? Does anybody inspect them?
The federal government would also.
And is there a certain number of guns that makes you a dealer?
I think there's a requirement. You have to sell 5 weapons a year to keep your federal firearm.
I possess, but sell.
Sell, because otherwise collectors would get an FFL just to get their first.
Just to bring it to a conclusion. You know, the activities of the legislation committee to go through this are important, but I'm just trying to resolve this. Are there complaints in the last couple of years driving potential review and change, or just reviewing the law? Again, something outdated, other laws have changed, superseding, preemptive, or we said this is interesting, time to move on. I mean, is there any action plan?
I've had concerns expressed by the Westchester Gun Owners Association as to how this law is being implemented and whether it's being implemented properly.
Okay.
So I don't know if others have, but I have, so I think it's worth it.
Well, so does it need a line of questioning to just follow up on that then?
And essentially has to do with how the searches or the inspections come about.
If
you're going into a private home, and what's the authority for that? And the law doesn't create the authority in and of itself.
So it sounds like the very specific question to look at is, should we try to get involved with this practice of the judges writing these letters or not? Is that what you're saying?
There's
a system going on now. If you said there's complaints, what do we do about it?
Let's see what the letters say, and let's look at its legality, and let's look at what the Supreme Court said.
Just to complete the record on this, there was some legislation in Albany, which we have discussed on occasion at the I guess when you were the chairman of the legislation committee. Bradley and Libel. The latest version I have is a 2007 version, but I think there was one in 2008 as well, where there were a couple of loopholes, or not loopholes, but things that needed to be cleaned up, and they were trying to deal with it in Albany. One of them was controlling the way the county clerk issues its record keeping, or keeps its records, and what's necessary for this process of recertification. I think that's a point of contention at the moment. But that's not necessarily the law that's before you.
Let me ask something. Did the recertification issue come up? I can recall, there's a certain, car licenses, our driver's license are renewed every 2 years, auto registration, I guess every 2 years, whatever it is. If I understand it, someone gets a gun license, and it's forever subject to this recertification.
Every 5 years.
Right. 5 years. So I guess, if you wanted to take on, I don't know who's really complaining, if you want to take on a macro look, well, why shouldn't there be, if it's good enough for license, for car license and cars, picking up 2, 3, 4 years, license is done. It's over.
Because this is all State Senator Spano and the gun owners.
Okay, so I'm saying there's obviously some reasons why.
We tried to do that.
Delve into that or not.
We tried to tie it in. We actually tried to tie it in with driver's licenses, mm-hmm. which would have been 4-year renewal. But because we were pushing for that, they decided no, they wanted to do 5.
But then a research. But the recertification, I'm hearing it's.
That's the answer to what happened.
That's the compromise. You have to get recertified, but the license is somehow not revoked. The license is there, but if it's not recertified,
that's a state law issue.
That's the state law.
So we can't get beyond. So for us to say every 3 years, Westchester gun license permits.
You got to amend the.
You have to go through the state.
It took us from 1991 to 1997, I guess. And a state senate campaign to get it changed.
And I think it is a can of worms. So unless what's the state? If it's not broke, don't fix it or something. Is there something we're dealing with that we need to deal with?
It's really got to be dealt with on the state level.
Okay.
And there are a couple of pieces in
there. Well, there is some question about the licenses and how we're issuing the licenses and whether they're in compliance with the state, which is not subject of with state law. That's not the subject of this meeting. So
correct. Yeah. You're right.
Some other meeting. But let's just spend a minute or two on the final one, which is the easiest one, the impoundment law. And Kristen, what were the concerns there?
Well, the vehicle impoundment law. Oh, Peter.
That's yours, right, Marty?
No, it's not Peter's.
Well, no, is this the one that the 12?
This is the 12 hours.
Yes, this is mine.
This again is a very carefully negotiated compromise.
This is the one where Pete had, this year we've gone, back when I was trying to do this, we were back and forth, we sort of compromised on this 12-hour rule, and I appreciate this change. I like this. Where are we with that?
Well, our main concern with this law was that the law, the way it's drafted, makes it sound like after this 12-hour period or somebody comes to get you or whatever happens, you're going to get your car back, and that's pretty much going to be it. Now there's the new vehicle forfeiture law that says after you're convicted of your DWI, if you are convicted, you can take the car can be taken away again. So we didn't know if maybe the law should be cross-referenced to mention each other, or somebody should be on notice when they're reading this law that, yeah, you're going to get your car back now, but it might not be forever. You might get the car taken away again.
So nothing. So something like nothing herein in this chapter shall affect the applicability of section so-and-so,
exactly.
Which deals with forfeiture.
Right. I think with Pete's law, I think we, if we go through that law as a standalone law, I think there are things in there that talk about giving notice, be prepared. Now, I guess it can't hurt to cross-reference in here, but I think your law took, it was a legitimate issue. How are people going
to
know about
the
law?
Yeah, they need to get written notice, time of arrest.
Right, so I think that law is sort of self-contained, but since there's other laws on the books, you point is, should one reference the other? I guess it's an opportunity to sort of let people know.
Related.
But I think some of the questions we have is just how well is this 12-hour law, how well is it working? Does it need to be 18 hours? Does it need to be cut back to 6 hours? Is it being enforced? Are people coming? Just generally,
Chief,
how is
the county police have the opportunity, that you have the opportunity to enforce this to a certain extent on the road?
We've been doing, the current law.
Yeah.
The
12-hour.
The one that's currently in effect, the impoundment. Yeah, how's that working out?
Well, prior to that, we've always taken cars off the road,
right,
as a safety issue, because we're a limited access highway. It'd be unsafe to leave them weighing on the shoulder. But we've been doing this for quite a few years now, since the local law was passed. And what happens, most of our cars are taken on Friday and Saturday night. They can't get them back on Monday anyway. They can't get them back from the tow service. And we don't have drunks picking up cars. And they have to come to headquarters to get a release. We have to examine, the driver. He has to show who he is, has to bring proof of insurance, the registration for the car, and two licensed drivers. And that's our common vehicle release policy. So I don't think anyone is, as a matter of fact, we're actually bagging more people at the counter to come in with expired license or suspended license.
Yeah. Another point of contact.
We need more drivers here or call a TLC as well.
Do you think it should be more than 12 hours? You think...
Well, the rule of thumb, is toxicologically speaking, it's an hour to metabolize every drink or every ounce of alcohol in you. But you have no idea, if someone is 1.5, we take the emergency room anyway, so they're going to at least be checked out. It blows the 1.5 BAC. So they're going to the ER. They're not going home. We got their car, they're going to the hospital, and that's someone that's really highly intoxicated.
Can you have a copy of it here?
2.5 and there are other ways to drive.
I have to say, I personally haven't heard of complaints about the 12 hours, that it should be 18, it should be 6. So, no one, law enforcement, no one's coming to complain. But the way the law is drafted, and this happens many times we pass laws, county police shall enforce this, must enforce this.
Yes.
Do you have any record? It seems like all the other local municipalities may, may sign on. Now, is there, from your experience, or is that something we should look at? Or I don't know, Tom, whether we can look at, we require, what's, is it enforced in half the municipalities? And you have some people, how is this law being enforced across the board? That's the bottom line.
I don't know what the other departments are doing. All I know is, the empirical data is that we don't know of any people that pick up their car and immediately get into a DWI accident. So that's something we have to try to review.
And then we charge for the towing, right?
Charge it for the towing and for the storage.
Anything else?
I'm sorry. I guess I'm going to the towing,
but you follow up, that's a separate.
Well, if you're before towing, can I make a point to your point?
Sure, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. If you remember during our discussions on the DWI, the forfeiture bill, when we looked at that from the there was that federal study of all the studies, I think it was San Francisco, that when they increased the time of impoundment, they saw a 25% drop in rearrest. So to your point and to the chair's point, that might be something we want to consider.
Well, at the time we were doing, it was, I was looking at it as a possible compromise to the extent there were some concerns about the, we haven't seen it, you know, it's not implemented yet, but the concerns of the potential impacts of that forfeiture, a compromise is going from 12 hours to 3 days. What's the due what's the time of due process? How long can you just simply hold it?
I'll pull the San Francisco study, if you'd like.
What did that say?
Well, in San Francisco, they lengthened the time of impoundment, and it had a deterrent effect on rearrest. I don't remember. I'll have to go back to my file.
It was at least 24 hours.
Yeah, it was a lengthy.
Yeah, but now you have forfeiture, so that would tend to do that.
It would have been a compromise to the forfeiture law, kind of just as a right. first step, hold the car longer. And someone says, geez, I'm going to lose my car for 24 hours.
Just informationally, Tom. Don't worry.
Pete, that's a good, you know, I mean, it's just out there. But that's what I was curious at. The 12 hours, how, you know, what impact.
Do we have any other questions on this?
Well, on the topic, let me just say for the record, on this issue, because it's come to towers for some reason, come to me. Their complaint, just generally about reviewing the laws, it's been on the books for 20 or 25 years, is $65, I guess it's a day, no, $65 to tow. I guess it's $65 to tow and there's a storage. That $65 has been on the books 20, 25 years. Their concern is, cost of everything, you know, has gone up in 25 years. And their White Plains is $125. The municipalities can impose their own. It's sort of like there's no preemption, it's equal. Their complaint is the county number is too low.
Is there a restriction on the storage cost?
The storage is, well, I think we have something in the law about our storage also, but it's $65 a day, and I don't know, is it $5 a day storage? Their big concern is the towing fee, because I guess people run off, Tom. Most people run off and get their car back, you know, within 2 hours if they can. But so there's the concern to me is the actual towing. As opposed to
so they're not feeling storage. Like they're being reimbursed.
They're not being reimbursed. They're expensive.
I think Kristen pointed out in a report. Yeah. It just says a reasonable fee for towing in court. We don't set the fee.
Well, that may be on this law.
Yeah.
But there's another
set
county
it somewhere
law
else.
Where it is set.
There is another law that controls. It's probably consumer protection.
It's consumer protection. And you know, the other side, you know, from a public, listen, the public is angry to paying $65. The cities, New Rochelle and White Plains, it's $125. I think. Yeah. And their complaint is, hey, we're the county lawmakers. Our number one of the books 25 years ago, and it's still 65. If you ever review the laws.
So can we look for that wherever that is in the law?
It's chapter 698.
What does it say?
So
we'll check that out. Maybe we need to increase that.
And that's the complaint.
Anything else on this law?
We actually did have one more question on the law.
Go ahead.
And this probably is a quick one. We were unsure of whether the law applies to every county road in Westchester, every road in Westchester County, or only county roads.
Well, I can answer that.
Yes.
Yeah,
it applies to the county police wherever they make the
right.
arrest. I don't think it applies to local police, but it's
unless they have their own municipal law.
So it applies to local police as well. They have the right to enforce.
They have the right to enforce, but they
have to.
You know, we should find out from the police chiefs if they actually use. I think most municipalities do use this. They impound vehicles. They don't let people drive away while they're intoxicated.
Well, laws
are they doing it under this law or something?
That elects to participate. Interesting question is whether the cops can do it themselves or whether they need the local government to.
It's a policy.
To set the policy.
As the chief said, they're not going to let someone drive away in an unsafe condition. So.
Yeah, but the person's probably not going to get out anyway. By the time they finish processing them, it's several hours.
Under the state law, under the VNT, you're only required to remove stolen cars, recovered stolen cars, or abandoned cars from the road, or any vehicles that are found to have drugs or gambling records in them. DWIs aren't covered under the state law, so we have to.
No, I think that's good.
We'll just look at the towing.
My issue is more of a consumer protection issue.
Are you guys coming over?
Yeah, right now.
Okay.
Does anybody have any follow-up on this law?
It's interesting. This is mandatory, not discretionary.
Does anybody have any follow-up we should do on this law, or should we leave it the way it is?
I'm not sure it's necessary to cross reference. I think Pete's
no. I mean, just for future discussion, I'll pull out the other,
maybe
the San Francisco study, and we'll see.
For legislation, we do have some minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of May 10, 2010?
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, you have some minutes.
Thank you. Great job.
Really
good
job.
Thank you, Betsy. Thanks, Chief Marnie.
Public safety minutes.
We need to do these?
Yeah.
Okay, we are just
so moved.
Minutes of May 10th, public statement. So moved by
second.
Mr. Harkin, all favor. Mr. Nona,
I have a motion to adjourn.
It is approved.
Motion to adjourn legislation.
Yes, motion to adjourn for public safety.
It's over. Where are we going?
We are
going
over to the courthouse.
Let's go to the second floor.
All right, let me hit the restroom real quick.
I'm not even sure what it is.
Go. Thanks. Good to see you.
Good morning.